A year into the Biden administration's tenure in office, seemingly little has changed in U.S.-China trade dynamics. The Trump-era tariffs remain. The so-called Phase One trade deal has yet to be fully implemented. The United States continues to embrace an increasingly restrictive approach to its trade and investment relationship with China, and virtually all of the underlying issues appear to remain stuck and largely unresolved. With the Biden administration's trade policy still under review more than a year into this term, some have characterized the Biden administration's approach to trade with China as, in essence, a fifth year of Trump administration policies. As we enter the second year of President Biden's term, where does the U.S.-China relationship, and specifically the U.S.-China trade relationship, appear to be going? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to explore these questions is Tim Stratford, managing partner at Covington & Burling's Beijing office and former assistant U.S. trade representative. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
Tim Stratford is, again, managing partner in Covington & Burling's Beijing office. His practice is focused on advising international clients doing business in China and assisting Chinese companies seeking to expand their businesses globally. As a former assistant U.S. trade representative responsible for trade negotiations between the United States and China, Mr. Stratford is the most senior former U.S. official currently working as a member of the U.S. business community in China. Except for the 5 years he spent in Washington at USTR, Mr. Stratford has lived and worked continuously in the Greater China region since 1982, including as Minister Counselor for Commercial Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and as General Counsel for General Motors China operations. Tim, let's start with a couple of scene-setting questions. What is your take on the state of U.S.-China trade relations today? And do you see any meaningful distinction between the policies of the current administration and those of the preceding administration where it comes to U.S.-China trade?
Sure. I think the main difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration is not on how they perceive the problems. I think that the U.S. government has outlined consistently over the last number of years a number of concerns they have where China's policies and their approaches are different from those of the United States. And there are some incompatibilities between the two approaches. And so I think Biden and Trump, the two presidents, both agreed on the nature of the problems, but I think they have very different senses of how the problems should be approached. The analogy I like to use is of football. Suppose you go to a football stadium and on one side of the field, you have the winners of the Super Bowl. And on the other side of the field, you have the winners of the World Cup. They're both there to play football, and they're very good at it, but they have a different understanding of the way the game is played. And if you try to picture those two teams on the same field at the same time, it could get pretty messy. People will be injured. There'll be a lot of misunderstanding. And I think if you look at differences between the Chinese economic development model and the U.S. economy, or you look in areas of national security, you look at ideology and human rights, you look at the way our law enforcement mechanisms work. There are a lot of incompatibilities, just like if you have a Super Bowl champion playing against a World Cup champion. So the question is how to deal with these interoperability problems given differences in our two systems. And I think President Biden is trying to develop a new approach different than the one that President Trump was using.
One area where many observers felt there could be a perceptible change in U.S. trade policy toward China was with respect to tariffs. Both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, on their respective debate stages as candidates, clearly stated that they felt the tariffs represented a misguided policy, the brunt of which was being borne by American consumers. And indeed, last summer, Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen stated that American consumers, and not China, are paying the tariffs, which of course is true. A year into this administration, why are these tariffs still on the books?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. First of all, we have to remember that the U.S. government imposed the tariffs in order to pressure China to change some of the elements of its economic system that the U.S. felt were hurting the U.S. and other countries. Well, the Chinese haven't made those changes. And so it would seem awkward for the Biden administration to lift those tariffs unless they can announce a new way that they're going to try to deal with the underlying problems. And in the meantime, they don't want to give up existing leverage to try to continue to get China to change some of these policies. So it doesn't seem like the right time to lift the tariffs from that point of view. Also, the Biden administration has emphasized that trade policy should be worker-centric. And so they don't want to increase market access by lowering tariffs unless they can also do something at the same time that will show that there's a benefit for American workers. And then a third problem is political. Republicans are arguing that the Biden administration is soft on China. And so as the Biden administration looks ahead to the midterm elections and also to the presidential election in another 3 years, they need to show by some other actions that they're also being tough on China. And therefore, this is delaying consideration of lifting the tariffs.
At this time, as we sit here in early 2022, what do you see, Tim, as the most fundamental and pernicious problems in the U.S.-China trade relationship, at least as viewed from a U.S. perspective?
I think actually from both countries' point of view, the biggest problem is a lack of trust. The U.S. government, when it was pushing China during the Trump administration to change some of its policies, they did it in a way that ended up, I think, being counterproductive. The U.S. was pressing China, for example, to not give such large subsidies to a number of its critical industries, such as in the semiconductor industry. If one country is subsidizing its companies and another country isn't, then it's hard for the companies from the unsubsidizing country to stay competitive over a long term against companies that continue to receive subsidies. So that's a big problem. So the Trump administration was pressing China to get rid of these subsidies. But at the same time that they were doing that, they were also, from other parts of the government, blocking semiconductor technology from going to China and putting companies like Huawei on an entity list, which sort of restricted the way that American companies could do business with them. So by cutting off technology to the Chinese government, what they were sending a message saying was, gee, you're probably going to have to subsidize those industries even more because we're not going to let you get technology from us anymore. So the Chinese government was getting these conflicting messages. And about the same time that this was going on, I recall back in February of 2019, I met with the vice foreign minister and he said, Tim, our party has concluded that it is now the policy of the U.S. government to undermine Communist Party rule of China. And if that's not true, the U.S. government better let us know very clearly and very quickly. And of course, at that time, given the different conflicting approaches that the U.S. was taking towards China, and also some of the rhetoric and some of the speeches from U.S. leaders, you can understand why Chinese leaders might have come to that conclusion. And so the result was, they decided that they couldn't trust the United States to be the same kind of economic partner that we had been in the past, and that they therefore better identify every place where there is some vulnerability and try to eliminate that vulnerability, develop their own technology, find other suppliers. And so this underlying change in approach between the two countries is our biggest challenge today.
Tim, picking up on a couple of points that you've just made, you've made the point, and I certainly agree, and I think most observers would agree, that U.S. policies over the last 5 years have failed to generate behavioral change in terms of China's approach to its economy and its approach to U.S.-China trade. I think that's self-evident, and I certainly agree with your assessment. Given that, let me ask you this question. What, in your judgment, would be a better or more surgical way for the United States to get the results that we're hoping to get, given that we clearly haven't been able to get those results over the last 5 years under the policies that have been in place? Or to put it differently, if you were giving two or three bullet point pieces of advice to the Biden administration, what would you advise this administration to do to get to a better place in terms of bottom line results for the American people?
I think, you know, that's really a question that everybody is grappling with. I think that what we saw during the Trump administration was an effort to try to compel China to change. But China felt that it was not in its interest to change, and therefore they resisted very strongly. I think that going ahead, our approaches to China, you know, especially in the economic area, but I suppose in these other areas of disagreement as well, is to try to start out with the assumption that China's probably not going to change. And so let's very objectively identify places where their approach is different from our approach, where those differences create interoperability problems, you know, such as one country subsidizing its companies and another country not subsidizing. Let's identify those areas. And then in the conversation with China, we can say, look, you have your system, we have ours. We can't compel you to change. It's, you know, your right to have your own system. But you need to understand that where there are these differences, they cause problems. And so we're either going to have to take other measures on our side to address those problems, or we would invite you to think if you can come up ways to address the problems. But they are problems and we've got to address them. It seems to me that that would create a framework for a kind of an objective discussion where we could try to solve problems and where we could try to identify safe harbors that say, okay, we're not going to be able to play on the same field in this particular part of the game because there's just no way to deal with incompatibilities. But we can carve out sort of safe harbors where if your companies do it in a certain way and we do it in a certain way, we recognize this and it will still be compatible and we can still at least do business with one another and collaborate in those ways. But I think that's a different way. Instead of trying to compel China to change, say, look, you can be different, but it causes problems. And so we're going to have to work together how we can address those problems.
No, Tim, I think that's a really interesting intellectual framework to apply. And it would represent a departure, I think, from, just as you've noted, from the way that the United States has thought about trying to get China to do what we want it to do. And, you know, this administration, the Biden administration, is focused on the notion of, as it puts it, managing competition responsibly. But as I've noted in some of my recent talks, and I think very much in accordance with the point that you're making, I think the more fundamental challenge that we face in this bilateral relationship is the idea of managing irreconcilability. Because the reality is, I think, just as you've said, certainly with respect to trade and also with respect to numerous other issues on the bilateral agenda, the fact is we're never going to see eye to eye on most of these issues, ever. And we'll never have a case where our two presidents meet and come out of the meeting and give a press statement saying, hey, everybody, it turns out we now agree on everything. And therefore, your point is very well taken, which is, given the United States' inability to bend China to its will, as evidenced over the last several years, for example, then how do you deal with China and what new approach do you take? And I think your point is a very interesting and very thoughtful one.
Let me just add, I think we need to recognize that this marks a change both in the way the United States would approach things, but also in the way China has approached things. When China joined the WTO, there were billboards all around Beijing saying, you sure jie jie gui, to align and integrate with the rest of the world. And when I was a U.S. trade negotiator, I could say, look, here's what China's doing. That's different from the global standard set forth by the WTO. You need to change so that you align with the WTO. And there was genuine openness in China to doing that. But now, you know, this many years, 20 years after China joined the WTO, the feeling in China is, you know, we're not so sure that we want to align with that particular view of the world order. We want to be a global power, but we think globalization should take place on terms that allow us to be who we want to be. And so the Chinese negotiating position is different, and I think we need to take that into account when we sit down and have negotiations. I don't want to try to downplay the seriousness of the differences between the two countries. They create very serious problems, but we have to think of how to get past the current logjam in terms of trying to open up the channels communication and finding a way that we can better manage the differences that exist.
I think that's really well said, Tim. And it actually leads very directly to the next question I want to ask you. Looking at the Chinese economy more broadly than just the U.S.-China trade relationship per se, is it fair to say at this point, nearly a decade into Xi Jinping's tenure as China's leader, that reform and opening up is officially dead? Or is that not a fair assessment? And another way to put it is, Does China now embrace a qualitatively different approach to running its economy? And if so, how would you characterize that approach and what would you call it?
I wouldn't say that reform and opening are dead, but I think that the direction of the reform and the nature of the opening up is changing rather significantly in its nature. As I mentioned, you know, starting in 1978, reform and opening for China meant aligning more with the world system. And certainly in many, many ways they have. I mean, when I first started practicing law in China in the early 1980s, they were doing some of the very first joint ventures with other countries. And we had to work together to figure out what sort of contracts would work and how we would deal with a lot of problems. And now China's legal system and their infrastructure in many ways is aligned with the world. And that's why they're such a great trading power. But again, they've decided that now they need to be, and they're in a position to be more selective. So they want to open up, but they want to be more careful in who they let in the country and what the people in the country are going to be doing. And they want to reform, but the reform is actually moving in a different direction. I remember leaders in the 80s were working to separate the party from government and from industry and from company management and so on. And the party, of course, would still lead, but it would lead more sort of on the theoretical level. But now, under President Xi Jinping, the party is changing its role again in the opposite direction. You know, President Xi has said, "Dang Jiang Jun Min Xue, Dong Nan Xi Bei Zhong, Dang Shi Ling Dao Yi Qie De." The party, the government, the military, society, education, north, south, east, west, the party leads everything. And so this is a kind of a reform of putting the party back in charge, even at the micro level, when previous reforms were moving in the other direction. But I think Xi Jinping believes that in order for China to assume its rightful place in the world, the party has to be in control of everything. And with that conviction, I think that's the direction that he's driving the country at this point.
Tim, on a related note, one of the features of China's new approach, if you will, to the economy in recent years has been the evident clipping of the wings of major private sector players, including most notably Jack Ma. What do you think China is trying to accomplish by cracking down on business leaders and other wealthy figures such as Jack Ma? Where is this going?
Well, I think it's part of what I was just talking about. I think that entrepreneurs and their very large companies were having so much influence and leverage in society that the party said, "Now, wait a minute, is Alibaba have more influence in society than the party?" And so I think they want to just make sure that the party's preeminence is reinforced in every way you turn. And I think that's part of what Jack Ma is seeing and what other Chinese entrepreneurs are seeing as well.
Tim, you've been a key leader within the U.S. business community in Beijing, twice serving as chairman of the board of AmCham China, and you're very deeply attuned to U.S. business sentiment in China and U.S. sentiment in particular within the corporate community regarding the Chinese market and Chinese economic policy. Where is the U.S. business community today on these matters? Has there been any appreciable shift over, say, the last year, for example, coinciding with President Biden's tenure in office, in U.S. corporate sentiment regarding China and also regarding the ability of U.S. companies to operate and succeed in the Chinese market?
Well, I think the Chinese economy is facing challenges that all economies do, given their different circumstances and their different approaches. But I think in many industries, China remains the most important market. And therefore, it's hard for a global company to ignore China or to think that they don't need to be there if they want to have the scale that they need to support, you know, ongoing R&D efforts and other things so that they can remain industry leaders in their own industry sector. But something new that's happened is that in some sectors, China may actually be a technology leader. And so that's another reason that foreign companies want to be in China. If you look at electric vehicles, for example, battery-powered vehicles, this is certainly an important wave of the future around the world. And China, in many ways, is leading in this sector. And so foreign companies want to be there to learn from Chinese technology. It's not just Chinese learning from foreign technology. So there are a lot of compelling reasons why companies feel a need to be in China. But at the same time, they're grappling with the types of uncertainties that we have been talking about. China is trying to eliminate any kind of leverage that the U.S. government may have. And so they're trying to localize certain types of technology and components and things. And so that may put Western companies and American companies at a disadvantage. They have to show that if the Chinese source from them or cooperate with them, it's not going to be cut off at some point in the future. And the U.S. is working to address concerns about the way China may be trying to subsidize its own industries, which disadvantages U.S. industry. So the U.S. is thinking about responses to that. They're thinking about national security and how to safeguard national security if American companies are investing in China or Chinese companies are investing in the U.S. And so all these things are happening, and there's a lot of uncertainty for the companies. I think since the Biden administration has come into office, I think foreign companies are disappointed that we don't have more clarity on how these issues are going to be managed, and that it seems to be taking a long time. I sympathize with that. I mean, I'm involved advising companies every day in how to deal with these uncertainties. On the other hand, I also recognize that these are immensely complicated problems, and it's going to take some time to sort them out. And so we just hope that the governments will be able to sit down and work together to come up with safe harbors and somehow come up with ways that the rules of engagement for companies will become more clear. In the meantime, I think it's very important for companies to understand the policy goals and concerns of each country and try to develop a business strategy that threads the needle and would be acceptable to both governments. And that's fairly challenging at times, but there are still opportunities to move in that direction. And I think we need to be putting a lot of effort into making that work.
Going to the more global level, Tim, you have tremendous depth regarding the World Trade Organization, WTO, and its role in both facilitating and regulating international trade. Is the WTO equipped, in your view, to manage global trade today, given the challenges that are so evident in this space? And if not, what organizational or procedural reforms need to occur so as to equip the WTO to be able to play its role more effectively in this new and much more contentious context? To put it maybe more directly, can the WTO in its present form survive another 10 years or even another five?
Well, it's a terrific question. I think we need to start out by saying that the WTO plays an indispensable role. I mean, if countries didn't feel obliged to comply with the basic rules of the WTO, the global trading system would be an absolute mess, and it would create economic hardship at all levels in most every country around the world. So I don't think we should be hasty and try to dismiss the WTO. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that it really hasn't been able to address the sort of problems that we've been talking about, the sort of problems that led the Trump administration finally to step outside of the WTO dispute settlement mechanism and to rely on tariffs, unilateral approaches to try to deal with the problems that the U.S. has had with China. The U.S. doing that was really contrary to the way the WTO is supposed to work. But they did it because the real world is changing more quickly than the WTO can adapt. The digital economy right now, it's so important around the world, but the economy is changing more quickly than all of the WTO members can get together and arrive at a consensus on what any new rules should be. And also, we have challenges with countries that are not terribly transparent in the way they do things. Or even if you take 2 years and spend a lot of money and bring a successful WTO case against them, they can quickly develop other trade practices that inflict the same type of harm as the one that you just sued them under the WTO for. So the WTO just has not been able to keep up with the challenges in the real world. Another problem is we're seeing today that national security is embedded in trade policy and trade considerations much more than it used to be. It used to be that the U.S. would say, by and large, our economy is open and we can trade with other countries. We have a few very sensitive technologies that are subject to export controls, and we have a few sensitive sectors where our CFIUS committee can review whether or not we'll let foreign investors invest in that particular U.S. business. But today, technologies that have vital national security applications are used in the way we order dinner and in the way we buy things, you know, using apps and things like that. And so it's very hard to separate national security from a trade policy. And the WTO is not really equipped to do that. And that leads me into a third point. If you have national security also involved in trade policy, that means that you really can only get agreement on certain issues with other countries that are like-minded in terms of national security and in terms of other policies. And so that means it's going to be pretty difficult to have all of the WTO members agree to the same policies when they have different national security interests and so on. So what I would see is that we should maintain the WTO as the lowest common denominator amongst trading partners. But then there will be other groups that will be formed of like-minded trading partners who have more compatibilities between their systems, and therefore they can have higher levels of commitments and get the benefits of that because they're like-minded and they're all willing to live by what you might call a kind of a higher law.
Tim, that's a really good point. Kind of WTO as least common denominator and then building up from there. Let me ask you two final questions, kind of big picture questions to wrap up what I think has been a really excellent and interesting discussion. Looking into the proverbial crystal ball, where do you see the U.S.-China trade relationship going over the next several years? Is there a realistic scenario in which the United States and China decouple to a significantly greater degree than they already have in some ways? And to what degree, if any, is there any real risk of the world seeing a bifurcated global economy of the type that to some degree existed during the Cold War era? Is that something that actually could happen?
It's something that could happen if we're not very thoughtful. It certainly isn't an optimal result for the peoples of our two countries. There are many ways in which our cooperation is very, very beneficial to all concerned. But right now, you know, when we don't have clear rules, you know, how to safeguard national security but maximize our economic engagement at the same time, we're kind of drifting with a riptide taking us out to sea. And there is increasing decouplization or decoupling that's happening because Chinese customers are cautious about buying things from the United States. American companies are cautious about sort of investments they should make in China and sourcing from China. They feel like they need to have diversified sourcing in case trade with China gets disrupted. So we have a kind of a riptide. You know, we're treading water as we're waiting for new policies, but the riptide is kind of carrying us further out to the decoupling sea. But what I hope is that as the governments start to really engage more on this, because it'll be in the best interest of both governments to do so, they'll be able to identify the really sensitive areas. They can build high walls around those sensitive areas, but then recognize that it will be very advantageous to promote business in the areas outside of those walls. Those are difficult technical questions, and then you have to have the level of trust and the constructive dialogue between negotiators of both governments to work out those rules. But I'm optimistic that we will ultimately move in that direction because that really would be in the best interest of both countries.
Finally, even more broadly, do you think the United States and China can get this really consequential bilateral relationship to a better place in the foreseeable future? And if so, what will it take from both sides to achieve that? Or is the current state of the relationship as strained as it is now about the best it can be given all the constraints on both sides?
I refuse to believe that it's the best that it can be. I remember hearing a speech by Jeff Bader, who used to be a senior director at the NSC for President Obama. Right when he left office, he came to Beijing. He gave a speech. I think it was at Tsinghua University. I was in the audience. And he gave a very candid talk about the problems in the bilateral relationship. I mean, it was respectful, but it was also very candid about the problems. And he sat down, and then a Chinese international relations professor stood up to sort of give a Chinese response. And he said, I wish I could be as optimistic as Dr. Bader. And I thought, wow, Dr. Bader was not Pollyannish in any respect. And then the Chinese professor talked about the Thucydides trap, which, of course, you're familiar with, David, the idea that if you have a dominant power and a rising power, the conflict between the two of them is almost inevitable because the rising power will want to continue to rise, but the dominant power won't want to share its power, and therefore there'll be frictions, and it ultimately will lead to conflict. So Jeff Bader then stood up afterwards and said, I understand the Thucydides trap theory, but I'm not an academician, I'm a practitioner. And I'm used to sitting across the table from my Chinese counterparts, and they're very smart, and they don't want conflict any more than I do. And it's because of my interactions with my Chinese counterparts that I believe that we will be able to work through these issues, and that we will be able to have a viable relationship that would be beneficial for both countries. And I'm with Jeff Bader on that. I've been a practitioner. You have too, David. And I have a lot of respect for many of my Chinese counterparts. And I just want to make sure that people can get in a room and have the space to try to work out these problems.
Absolutely, Tim. And I think that's a great vision. And I couldn't agree more. I think, God forbid, that the present state of U.S.-China relations is the best that it can be, because that doesn't augur well for anyone in the world, and certainly not for the United States or China. Tim, I want to thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your deep insights on these really important questions. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, David.
Remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. As always, thank you all so much for listening.